I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we usually call it. This one is more a global conversation about American attitudes in something like an imperial meltdown. Short form, it's deeper than they've told us, much worse than those AIG bonuses. Questions we're batting around here. Does China get to win the financial crisis? Is the pillar of U.S. authority about to crash the way the Soviet side of the old Cold War collapsed 20 years ago? Is there any safe way past the bursting of the finance bubble? What we have here is dugout chatter, talk between sessions at a conference at Brown on the almost superpowers Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, in an acronym, the BRICSA countries. For open source purposes, it was a chance to talk with real players like the former chancellor of Austria, a Chinese sociologist, a businessman, and a documentarian from India about the emergency in credit, debt, jobs, trade, and for starters, this huge imbalance in production and consumption around the world. My conversation began with a left-wing law professor from Italy. He teaches also in Los Angeles, Ugo Mattei. Ugo Mattei, I thought you asked the most interesting question of the session about the shape of this crisis.
Thank you very much for this. I just asked a very simple question. If this is the end of capitalism, maybe we should compare it with the end of socialism and communism. And so maybe today Barack Obama in this country is performing the same role that Mikhail Gorbachev was performing in the times of the collapse of socialism. And this was the question, basically, whether we could learn something from the previous experience of 20 years ago. One of the actors of the Cold War collapsed. Now the second one is collapsing. And who is leading it? Maybe the best possible man to lead the transition, but the transition is impossible. And we are just going to see a crisis of historical proportions.
Nobody wants to say it, but is this a terminal crisis of capitalism?
I believe it is. The level of unsustainability of our model of development brought us to the final point. So now there is going to be a major systemic crash, and we are going to have to start back from the scratch. And it's going to be very important to try to see what we can manage to do in a new era, in a new civilization, and perhaps in this new start we should and we will be able finally to get to live in good terms with nature, giving up this idea that humans control nature and getting back to the notion that we are part of nature and we have to live with it and not always trying to dominate it by imposing our property structures over it.
The idea of Gorbachev as a model is fascinating. First, because he tried with glasnost, perestroika to save the game, but then in the end, he gave it up without a fight.
Yeah, and also, I had enormous sympathy for Gorbachev at the time, as I have enormous sympathy for Barack Obama now. I think that he is just playing a game that is probably beyond the possibility of any human being, that is to save from wreckage a model that is fundamentally gone. And so probably also Barack, after 1, 2, 3 years, will try to give it up, and we'll see whether it's going to be as peaceful here as it has been in a certain perspective out there. There are some structural reasons that brought us here. And those structural reasons are rooted in our conception of law and in our conception of nature and in our conception of property. We are like someone that have discovered a treasure that was hidden for many, many centuries, millions of years perhaps, and in just a few generations has been, you know, spending like crazy all of the treasure. And the treasure is simply not there anymore. And the treasure is, you know, clean air, clean water, oil, resources, animals, biodiversity, you name it. And now that is just has been spoiled almost completely. So we will have to start again without the treasure. Capitalism was the most efficient way to spend fast something that we haven't produced, that, you know, nature has produced for us. And we've been, socialism and communism was an attempt probably to also exploit those resources, maybe with a different long-term plan in mind, but still was rooted in an idea that humans own nature. And I don't believe this is sustainable anymore. Now we are realizing it's not. And we need a lot of courage. We need a lot of courage to stop thinking about ideas such as development, growth, you know, and all the sort of concepts that are considered good per se, but in fact are not.
And free trade and all of those other great, great phrases.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's and rule of law particular. You know, this notion of universal ideas of rule of law and of democracy are those among the ideological apparatus that made everybody persuaded that this is the best possible way out there.
Let me ask you all, and maybe Nandan, this is your turn. What if this is not a cyclical downturn at all, but a huge systemic crisis as deep as the collapse of Soviet communism 20 years ago, which changed everything? What if Barack Obama is our Gorbachev?
Well, two things. One is I don't think that this crisis is that apocalypse about to happen. The second is I have definitely differ with Hugo that Gorbachev voluntarily left power. He was left with no option. But coming back to the...
It's an option maybe that Barack Obama wouldn't be given.
Well, then he'd be in Gorbachev's place, that's it. But not because he wanted to. But coming back to the original question, I mean, we're talking of redistribution and all this, and it was a thought in my mind that there is no individual way out. You know, if you look at it, China and India, in theory, have the resources and have the ability to generate an internal market and maybe somehow survive the crisis. But unfortunately, the world has become so interdependent that there are several other aspects which are going to play along with this. And whatever internal domestic decisions you take thinking about your domestic imperatives, they're not going to work out in this particular crisis. So my personal view is we absolutely need international cooperation on this. We absolutely need to discuss this all together. And unfortunately, I tend to see that there is not much, unfortunately, in terms of difference in unilateralism between Obama and Bush. You are taking unilateral decisions. And perforce, forcing us to operate within the same system. You know, because your decided stimulus is the way out, you are essentially trying to force everyone else to accept the stimulus path as the way out, which may not necessarily be the correct way. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a, you know, purebred economist in that sense. But I think this requires discussion. Although, one final point is, it is my belief that if you look at the way it is structured in Obama's $750 billion or $850 billion that he's doling out, there are clear elements where he is allocating money to ensure that certain sectors within the U.S. economy revive, and hopefully the economy is pulled out by those sectors.
What's the alternative, as you see it, to stimulus, more consumption?
No, I think, again, this is a question of discussion because this crisis is affecting the rest of the world. So it's not just a crisis that's in the United States. But I think you will have to look at a combination of stimulus and regulation. You know, it cannot be just this because part of the problem, I'm not saying this is the only reason, but part of the problem is that the U.S. financial markets were completely unregulated. And you were creating money, you know, where there was no money. As Samir in his presentation pointed out, you know, you were really over-leveraged 500% and stuff like that. So in that situation, it had to crash.
Chancellor Gusenbauer, what are you learning and what do you think about the size, the scope, the survivability of this crisis? What's at stake?
Well, I think there are still three different options. One is the fundamental crash of the world economy. The second is what we call the Japanese development, more or less a stagnation for the next 10 years. And the third option is that we are able to resolve the crisis within the next 2 or 3 years. But this only will be possible if there is an international management that is trying to reconcile some of the most fundamental reasons that led to the crisis. And this, in my understanding, is not only, let's say, the wild financial markets, but these are the fundamental imbalances that are inherent in the present world economy. And without balancing those, I think there is no way out of the crisis.
Mr. Guzenbauer, you said right from the start, it seemed to me, that we've got huge imbalances here of not only imports, exports, wealth, poverty, ideas, and there seems to be no balancing stroke in sight. What's to do?
Well, I think the most important meeting that will be held in the beginning of April is the G20 meeting, because this might be the forum to get an agreement on some of the issues. But more fundamentally, I think the pursuit of greed will not help to solve the crisis. What one has to understand is that there will not be a recovery without redistribution, because the main element will be to increase the demand. And to increase the demand means to put millions and millions of people who still have the desire and the wish to consume more because they are underprivileged, to put them in this position. So if nations or social classes pursue what they have done and what led to the crisis right now, there will be no way out. So one has to understand that one key for the resolution is to abandon the concept of greed and to adopt a concept of sharing.
That's a big assignment.
Well, but I mean, normally people are following their self-interest as long as they come to the understanding that if they pursue their self-interest, they will destroy their self-interest. And I think we have come very close to such a point. And on the level of nations, of course, that requires some debate. I mean, the United States at the moment are quite unilateral in their attempt to resolve the crisis. Everybody knows what will be the result. The U.S. might enter major inflation by this year or the beginning of next year. So the Chinese observe that and say, well, all our dollars that we have in the pockets, we will lose a lot of value in the time to come. So they are going all around the world on shopping tour and trying to convert their dollars into real assets. And I think that to pursue those individual strategies will not help to solve the crisis.
Let me ask you, as a complete amateur, I sit here listening as carefully as I can. What I hear is that barring some major intervention, China wins this collapse. It has cash. It has a strong top-down regime. It has a domestic market if it wants to open it up. It has, somebody said here, a combination of Milton Friedman and Stalin running the show. Can China win this crisis?
Well, I think that apart from the result of the crisis, China will be one of the two main players in the world anyhow. And some others, they try to benefit from this crisis situation. On the other hand, I don't think that the Chinese success model can be sustained for a longer time, because if you are implementing market economy, different interests will develop, different interests that search for their social and political expression. And I think that this combination of Stalin and Milton Friedman sounds appealing to them, but I'm deeply convinced that this is not sustainable.
Mr. Hong, China is now openly nervous about this,
$1 trillion worth of T-bills that they have. Why are they saying it? What does it mean? And while we're at it, do you think, you know, China can win this crisis, so to speak? Should China win it?
I think it is still too early to say, and China has a great possibility to win, depending on what it is going to do to cope with the crisis. China is hit by the crisis with a time lag because it is bought a lot of toxic assets. So when the financial crisis struck, that China is not directly hit, but there's a time lag because when Western consumers, particularly in the U.S., start losing their jobs and start losing their consumption power, then China will start to have great trouble. As the data it has already shown it, that because China has an export-oriented growth, and when West and built on its prosperity in the last 20 years by exporting cheap products to American and European consumers, and at the same time lending money to the American consumers to consume Chinese goods. So when now the financial bubble is bursting, and when American consumers and also European consumers and Japanese consumers starting to restrain their spending, then the China export engine, which is the locomotive of its prosperity in the last 20 years, is having great trouble, and it is leading to bankruptcy, leading to of many export-oriented enterprises, and also disappearance of employment, of jobs. And so there's a great economic crisis brewing in China right now, and it can easily turn into social and political crisis. Mm-hmm. If the Chinese government doesn't manage the crisis wisely, then it can basically bring down the last 20 years of trajectories of growth and prosperity. But I'm saying that China also has the means and the potential to cope with the crisis wisely, that is to shift its developmental model from an export-oriented orientation to a more domestic consumption-driven mode of development. But it is not easy because of the last 20 years of hyper export-oriented growth. China already witnessed the rise of vested interests in the coastal cities and in the export sector that basically hijacked the policy-making mechanism of the central government. So when the central government is talking about shifting to domestic consumption, it has to involve a lot of redistribution that you talked about just a minute ago, that to redirect resources from the coastal export-oriented province to the inland agricultural area so that underprivileged people who send their sons and daughters to the city to work as migrants can benefit from the prosperity, so that they can also spend and buy China product. And it is going to be a healthy move, but a difficult move because of the vested interest. So far, because of the political system of China, these people in the inland and who actually are the losers in the last 20 years of prosperity has low say and no leverage to influence the China government's policy. So
the export folks are still in charge.
It is pretty much, and actually it is amazing that over the last 2 years there is a kind of a struggle. It's not quite a struggle. It is proceeding smoothly about who is going to be the successor of Hu Jintao. And there is a two person. That is, one person is more representing the inland interests and underprivileged interests, and there is one Xi Jinping who is representing the coastal interests. And in the end, now it is settled that it is the guy who represents the coastal interests to be the high parent of Hu Jintao. So it seems to me that quite obvious actually that the coastal export-oriented interest is still in charge.
I want to ask Nandan Unnikrishnan, who was it here said India's dream would be for the United States to consume less and the Chinese to produce less?
Well, that was, the author is right here, Samir. I think Samir should answer that question. Samir Saran.
No, I mean, that was actually a part of a speech given by a special envoy to the Prime Minister. And he had remarked in the course of his speech that this is one of the structural imbalances, that the U.S. is saving less and consuming more, and China saves entirely and keeps producing. And he says this is one of the structural imbalances, which is the causation, you know, could be one of the causations. And obviously the U.S. would want us to believe it's because China saves and produces so much, and vice versa. But this is just one of the imbalances. The second imbalance, I think, that we must look at, as the previous speaker mentioned, was obviously the complexity quotient. And we have not really, you know, delved into this. The operations were becoming less and less transparent because the financial networks, the financial markets were getting networked across the globe. So while the regulations were domestic, the markets were global and they were interconnected. There was complete lack of transparency in their operations and the lack of any regulator to govern them, any domestic regulator to govern them. This allowed basically a market problem to infect institutions and finally countries. And this is another factor that India believes needs to be addressed. And like you said, you know, this is something that countries need to sit together and come up with a framework where prudential practices. Maybe a supra regulator may be a bad idea in terms of creating a new regulatory body. Maybe we can work with existing systems. But in terms of voice, in terms of votes, in terms of democratic representation in any of the world bodies that we may want to, we may want solving this problem, we need to address this.
I don't generally quote Tom Friedman as an authority on anything except our wayward empire. But he asked the other day in his New York Times column an interesting question. What if this crisis, the financial crisis, is a kind of message, a wake-up call that tornado capitalism is ruining the planet? It's turned us into malls and debt on this patch of the planet and factories on the other, with a great deal of impoverishment of land and people everywhere else. I mean, he's worried that it's a formula for destroying the planet.
Well, first I have to say it's not the market economy or capitalism as such that failed. It was this exaggerated type of financial capitalism that failed. And I think that one has to be ready to undertake several changes and adoptions. The first thing is the leverage has been far too high, and by that the bubble has been created, artificial money that was never there. The second thing is you have to reconnect finance with the real economy. And the third thing is one has to understand that not everybody can participate on the same side, because then the game is not happening. If everybody says, we just want to produce and to export, but we do not want to consume, then the game is not functioning. And if you have these imbalances right now, how could you address them? Of course, it's important that now some additional money is put in, but one should reach an understanding that, for instance, the U.S. within the next years gradually is increasing its saving rate. At the same time, one could agree that the Chinese are continuing with the appreciation of their currency, which they did for several years already, and that they are increasing their domestic demand. On the third hand, one could agree what should be the inflation target for the next years. No, we do not need necessarily an inflation target of 2%, and if we expect to have hyperinflation in some parts of the world, it might be useful to agree on an inflation target of, let's say, 4 or 5% over the next 5 years to moderate this type of process. So there are different elements that could compose such a package deal, which will not mean the end of capitalism or the end of market economy, but it will be a different type of market economy that, in my understanding, has to be more equitable than the one we had right now.
You're giving me a wonderful half-technical answer, but I'm looking also for a kind of spiritual big-picture grappling with a kind of warning here that we have created a shopping culture and a production culture on opposite sides of the world, huge debt, huge imbalance, a capitalist system that does not feed half the world, and that we're getting a wake-up call. This thing isn't working. It's also destroying the environment.
I'm convinced that what we need is a social culture and a culture of sustainability. And maybe one of the chances of the crisis right now is when all these stimulus packages are agreed upon, that major investment is taking place in energy efficiency and renewable energy and questions like that, all the green technology that will contribute to a more sustainable development. But I think it has been proven by history that capitalism without social consensus and without a consensus with nature is not sustainable.
And this is to go back to your thing about, Hugo talking about Gorbachev and all. I remember Gorbachev once spoke about socialism with a human face. I mean, what we really require right now is capitalism with a human face.
I mean, I would probably call it, now we need, the time is for real capitalism. Capitalism worked very well till the 80s. In fact, I'm just going back to the point of leveraging. In 1980, the global GDP and the financial assets in the world were roughly the same. The financial derivatives were 108% of the real GDP, which basically meant that what you had on paper was what you had in hand. Now they're 14 times. So what really the need for today is to have real capitalism, which is based on what you actually can produce and can consume, and not what you will produce 14 years hence and consume 50 years thereafter. And that is how today companies are valued. And that is something that we need to relook at. So it's the financial system that needs a complete overhaul.
Back to 1980 seems to be the cry, the banner.
Absolutely. And I think there'll be lots of financial engineers who lose their job in that way.
China surely does not want to go back to 1980.
No, that many people in China and I actually don't think that it is now the end of capitalism or the end of free market. But it is the end of self-regulating market, the pretension that market can work its way out of trouble and create prosperity. Definitely we need to have more regulation, and all I agree with the idea about the capitalism of a human face. So China won't go back to Maoism or Stalinism, but a capitalism with a more human face. And whether it is a crisis that ends the age of growth, or it depends on where, what part of the world you are talking about, that or the end of the age of consumption. Because in the imbalance in the last 20 years in the global capitalist system, there is a certain part of the world that is over. Oh, there's overconsumption, like the U.S. and Europe, but there are also places there's underconsumption. That in China and many rural areas in India and in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in Brazil, that when people are talking about boosting consumption in global South, people think that it might not be a good idea. It might destroy the environment, and of course, environment is important. At the same time, that consumption is not necessarily a luxury or bad thing for a lot of people in the world. It's not talking about, like, for example, in the U.S. that Paris Hilton has just launched a new label to sell apparel and garment for dogs. So it is not the kind of consumption that is going to be good. So there's overconsumption in the U.S. and in Europe. So it is the end of growth and consumption of this kind that make the crisis make us aware of, but it doesn't mean that it is the end of growth and consumption. On the other hand, we need more growth and more consumption in the global South. So it is kind of a redistribution of growth rate.
Nandan, it's fascinating for an American to hear your perspective that there's a more continuity than you expected from Bush to Obama in the recovery plan. We voted for change. What kind of change could you reasonably expect from the American government in this period? I'd ask that to all of you.
Well, there are two distinct things. There's Obama in the foreign policy sphere, where he is distinctly different from Bush. And there is Obama, let's say, in the internal domestic economic sphere, where Bush also looked at, or the Bush administration saw the way out through stimulus and consumption and get the Chinese to export their way out of the crisis and let us consume more and more, and maybe we will get out of this crisis. But that, I suspect, is not a fault of Obama. I mean, if you look at it, he's walked in, he's barely a month old. He needs time. And hopefully, over a period of the next 2-3 months, I mean, there's a G20 meeting and there are others, there will be an understanding. I think there is a difference with Obama and Bush in the sense that Obama is, at least right now, appears to be willing to listen to other opinions. I mean, whether he will later consider them and take them on board is a different issue, but at least he's willing to listen.
Chancellor Gusenbauer, what kind of difference, what kind of break would you like to see from the American government?
I think that the U.S. government should move from a confrontational view on the world to a cooperative view on the world. And I think this would be the most important move that can be undertaken within the next year. And the second element is what I think is wise in the stimulus package, are this $150 or $160 billion dollars that are going in renewable energies and in green technology, because this is a clear indication that the U.S. nowadays wants to take the lead in green technologies, and for many, many years has been the major obstacle against the greening of the world.
You know, I would just like to jump in here, and I think this is one particular aspect that we must be careful about. Obama has announced this great decision to go for green technologies, but therein also comes an adage or a rider attached to it, and that says that America must take lead and must be the leader in this technology, which implies intellectual property and a certain hegemonic discourse thereafter. So if capitalism was to use the green technologies and green capitalism was to actually become a reality, then instead of the previous Bush era or the before, even before that, the previous era of oil-derived political discourses across the globe, we may have green political discourses with again the same hegemon, which is the US. And we don't want, and we should not expect environment and climate change to become actually a tool of money making. It should be, it should not become an instrument of trade, and it should be an instrument of sustainability. And I think that's something that Obama must point out. But at the same time, on the basic question, I think Obama is more capable of handling this crisis than Bush is, but at the same time, he's more dangerous. He's smarter. And as the continuity is that there is still that propensity to be unilateral in decision-making. In a way, he has already set the agenda for what the world is going to do. And it'll be very difficult for him to back down politically at home. So I do not see the G20 achieving much when they meet in April this year, because they are a divided lot.
Explain the downside of having a smart leader of the United States, especially. What's the problem? When does it become a problem?
Obama, good thing and also the bad thing is that he knows that there's a trend that we are entering into a post-American world, that he read the book, and everybody knows that he read the book, and Bush basically doesn't read the book, so he doesn't know about it. Then, and it is a good thing that he know that, but also he, because he knows that there's a trend, so his agenda, as he expressed in his inauguration address, that is to counter this trend, to work against this trend, to let U.S. to be the unique leader for the next 20 or 30 years. So he knows that what is going on, and he's trying very hard and for the green technology, and he's also speaking in the language of competition, that is to outcompete other potential green technology countries like Korea and Japan, and he said a lot of other countries. So it is a bad thing, because if you still have this competition, compete to be the world leader, then this mentality is not going to work. What I see is the better alternative to the world is a world without one single leader, but a brotherhood of leaders, in a brotherhood of intercontinental or interregional governance.
Last word?
He did.
Yeah. Ugo Mate.
Well, I have a lot of things to say, but let me stay on this thing of Obama for a second. I believe there is a huge thing to be done from the United States that is trying to begin declare their own intellectual bankruptcy when they have transformed human experience into a technological game. The human life has nothing to do only with technology. Law is not engineering. Politics is not engineering, is not technology. I mean, there has been a complete distortion, I think, in the way of thinking in this last 25, 30 years in the United States, that just because, you know, they were enjoying a technological advantage, that meant that they were intellectually superior to the others. So either now there is a humble declaration of bankruptcy of this kind of attitude, and all the rest will follow, or we are back to the beginning. I personally think that there is so much to be done in terms of dismantling the military apparatus, and nothing is happening in this particular side. So starting talking about, you know, greening the capitalism, all this kind of stuff, when the world is infested by, you know, American military bases with nuclear weapons, with consuming lots of energy, creating a disaster wherever they are, socially, morally, and intellectually, it is only once again talking about these things as if it was some sort of things that can be understood in numbers. This thing has to be understood politically, and requires a new humanism, requires a vision of long term, requires a real transformation. This is why I hope that the crisis is going to go really, really bad so that then we can restart.
That's fascinating. I mean, I love the call for a new humanism. Get a recognizable human soul and spirit back into this picture. But in Russia, it took a genuine collapse. Is this a crisis of that scope in which this other pillar of the Cold War actually falls apart and we have to start from scratch or not?
I think it's very easy. In history, crisis of that size normally led to revolution or war. And our task nowadays is to handle that crisis and to overcome that crisis, at least without wars, but a revolution of our minds, I think, is utterly necessary.
I completely agree. Mindset change should be the agenda of the day.
Mm. Who's to lead it better than Barack Obama?
No, I think it'll have to be the Americans who will lead it. Let's be honest. They are 30% of global GDP, you know. And the fact is that they've already put in $1.5 trillion. That's more than India's GDP for 1.5 years, you know. So the scales are completely on a different level. So it has to be America. It has to be American who have to lead it, but they have to lead it with consensus. They can't be unilateral decision making. So it has to be more consensual.
This was a good last work. We agree on that.
Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
The talkers in the dugout here were the socialist former Chancellor of Austria, Alfred Gusenbauer, the sociologist of China and the transformation of global capitalism, Ho Fung Hung, the Indian businessman Samir Saran, also the journalist and documentarian Nandan Unnikrishnan, and Ugo Mate of Torino and the University of California's Hastings College of Law. Paul McCarthy edited this conversation for Open Source. Feedback. Define the crisis yourself at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.